Welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. We have a pretty fascinating show for you today, running down quickly what we'll be covering today. We're going to be talking about, many of you are in school, going back to school, thinking about school, hopefully not elementary school. You listeners are a little bit young for us, but college, graduate school, and beyond. We're going to talk about our experiences with that in the past in our chat. Then we are going to tackle the topic of flirting during our roundtable. Flirting, is it even appropriate? Should we talk about it? If it's not appropriate, we'll have about 10 seconds of discussion and move on. So we'll see. Then our culture segment today is actually with Focus on the Family Senior Vice President Tom Minnery. He's our Senior Vice President of Public Policy, talking about looking in light of the election, kind of the whole issue of social justice, which we've addressed on the blog. So we're going to tackle it by voice as well. And then our Q&A today is going to be on the topic of how can mentors speak into someone's life. We're going to be talking to a mentor couple, just about a couple that they know that maybe has gotten a little off track in their relationship, and they need to figure out how to address some of the issues that they are dealing with. And then finally, make sure you stay tuned for the Hungry Years as well. Back again, the Hungry Years, this time with Steve Waters talking about his dad meeting Elvis. Before he died. We know that he's still around somewhere, but this is before he died in 77. So anyway, so I have Ted Slater, Ted, editor of Boundless, here in the studio.
Hi, Lisa.
Hey, Ted. Good to see you.
Good seeing you.
And he was telling us a little earlier about his weed whacker or whatever he has. And right. then
Steve. And we determined that was not going to be interesting to our listeners.
So we just gave that a pass. And then we have Steve here. Steve.
Good to be back.
Director of our Young Adults Ministry here at Focus on the Family in the studio. And we have two guests. We have Shiloh Bignell.
Hello.
Hey, Shiloh. Shiloh is an employee here at Focus on the Family, single, and a friend of mine. You may remember her from our online dating female version podcast episode where she gave us fabulous insights on
her
experiences.
Oh, she stole the show.
Yeah,
she stole the show.
She was there. And then we also have Mark Weber in the studio.
Hello, Lisa.
Mark, good to see you.
Mark has actually helped us behind the board a couple of times.
He has.
Yeah. I have a shining glass today.
That's right.
And Mark is also single.
He is, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Both of them are single.
That's a very important
thing. Yes. Shiloh works in product acquisitions for us, so she has a cubicle full of stuff that she has to evaluate and determine if it's too cheesy for the Focus shelves. And whether or not we can offer them to our constituents. And then Mark is within the bowels of Focus on the Family, working in audio production, and he edits our daily broadcast with Dr. Dobson, which y'all listen to faithfully, we know. So anyway.
And I thank you for that.
Yeah. Yes, listen. Exactly. So, but we want to talk a little bit about college today and our experiences in college, just briefly, the whole concept of, we have a lot of listeners, what's our percentage? You guys give it a shout.
Half.
50, yeah.
About half who are in school, in college or graduate school, is what we're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Does that include the people who are like 45 and just haven't quite landed yet or what?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
We put them in the number. But generally, some of our younger 20s who are still deciding on that career path and getting through college. And but you, Steve, were talking yesterday about just your experience in college, which was, what, 2 or 3 years ago?
It's amazing how quickly it gets past you. I actually, 10 years out of graduate school. And, you know, that's the thing I was thinking about this time of year, 12 years ago. I was just now realizing, okay, I want to go to graduate school this fall. And for a lot of people, right now is the time when they're getting classes started again. They're either starting as a freshman, going back as a sophomore or whatever. I've noticed, though, for a lot of people, grad school is one of those things that, you know, after months and months of planning for undergrad, grad school is one of those things that people often do spur the moment. And that's exactly what I was doing around this time 12 years ago, was thinking, I think I want to go to graduate school this fall. And just the scramble of trying to get in and missing out on all the deadlines for any kind of scholarships or financial aid. And so I just realized how dramatically different that was from undergrad and the experiences you have thinking about going back into the school setting after you've been doing it all your life. It just feels so natural.
Did any of you go to school and just cry? Guys, too?
Just
first
cry.
Day, first week, whatever.
Ooh.
I mean, it was like, for me, it was kind of a whiplash for me. I was actually contemplating going to an Ivy League school. I ended up going to a small Christian college in the Midwest. I went there sight unseen. I did not visit it prior to going. I drove with my parents 2,000 miles. They dropped me off. I remember them driving away, and I stood in my dorm room, and it was like Alcatraz. I had this metal bed with a metal nightstand, this nasty carpet. I did not know anyone, and I'm just like, I am literally going to cinder block walls. And I was like, I will meet my death here. I will not be able to survive. And I remember just crying and crying. I had to go off to some, you know, whatever freshman event or whatnot.
Well, I stumbled through the first couple of years of college. I got a couple of D's the first semester and dropped out and took a year off, then went back to college and went a semester and dropped out for another year or so. And then sort of on a whim, sometime in September, I decided, I think I'm going to go back to college this year. So the day of first classes, I drove up to the local college about an hour and a half away, applied, and I didn't have a dorm room because I didn't have any money, so I ended up staying in my car and staying with some friends and bouncing around, and eventually became a little less ambiguous in my educational pursuits. But
going back to your question, Lisa, I certainly understand, you know, that homesick feeling. I was really close with my family, and then, you know, the first week at college, you know, don't smell the good food cooking in the oven, you know, from mom and all this stuff, you know, it's the cinder block walls and everything.
Well, ramen noodles smell really good when you start cooking them up.
You know, and you do smell them a lot, I gotta say, you know, in good old mac and cheese, you know.
Well, it does get better, so we want to encourage everyone out there that there is hope, especially if you're going into your freshman year. And make sure, for those of you that are in college, that you are familiar with TrueU.org, which is our website here at Focus on the Family, specifically for college students. That is True, the letter U.org. They have a lot of great resources for you, and I think it is just encouraging to realize that it does get better. You do meet people. You do start building a sense of community to the point where, you know, after your time spent there, you really see that as a portion of your life that was valuable, and you will have fun stories out of it. I was just thinking the whole cafeteria thing. We had a guy in our cafeteria named Ivan who worked the serving line with a sponge attached to his forehead because just to catch the sweat.
Oh.
So, like, literally, he's like spooning out food, and he just had this like sponge rubber banded on his forehead. He was probably like 70. He was just the cutest. So, woo, good times with that. But, well, anyway, make sure you all keep us posted on your college experiences. We want to send you off well and want to encourage you in that. And, of course, listen to us while you're there and keep up with the Boundless Webzine in the process.
Tell me of the years gone by and all the promises of just one try. And tell me of that still small voice that never left me with each wrong choice. Tell me of his mercy, mine, as each new path forbidden walls. And tell me of the crimson stain that ran so deep in holy rain. I heard it all, but tell me once again, it's time to let it show that I really understand the mercy and the grace that ever flowed. Stop and
are ready to delve into today's roundtable with the team back here. Shiloh, Mark, Ted, and Steve with me here in the studio to talk about a fascinating topic, that of flirting, which we're drawing on Steve and Ted for perhaps some past experience.
But I think flirting works in marriage, or it should still be going on in marriage.
Yes.
Because you can kick it up a notch.
Yeah. So we'll have our admonitions for them later on.
Because Ted and I are Olympic record flirters.
Yes.
That's why we're on the show.
Exactly. And then myself and Mark and Shlo are kind of in the, you know, pool of singles currently. So we have to find out what's right mm-hmm. and what's not, what's hot and what's not. So I just want to start the conversation by generally saying that people will listen to this and say, oh, you know, it'll be everything from Christians shouldn't flirt at all because that's just inappropriate. You should just go to a well somewhere and or send your servant to a well and have them find someone for you and bring them back and get married and start filling your jars with water or whatever you need to do. To the opposite extreme of just mirror the culture's expectations of dating and be out in the bars and the clubs and just work it and do what you can. So we don't know where you are on that continuum. Maybe we don't want to know, but we're going to talk just, I'm going to throw out the question, is flirting appropriate for Christians?
Hey, Lisa, let me throw out maybe a definition first. This yes. is just something I'm making up. I didn't look it up or anything.
Okay. I looked it up.
Let me throw something out and then you can correct me, Shlo. I would say maybe flirting is the non-threatening communication of relational interest.
Wow.
Is that pretty close?
I like that.
What would you say,
Shlo? It just rolls off the tongue.
Well, I didn't like the answers I found on dictionary.com, nor my little dictionary at my desk. It talked about coy romantic overtures, and it's also, so they discuss it being in a sexual nature, and it's also when you don't have...
Well, it is kind of, because I don't flirt with guys.
True.
Never have.
But also, it's supposed to be you're trifling with someone, that they aren't serious. And so I think, as Christians, maybe that's where we'd have some good boundaries.
Because we don't trivialize relationship.
Correct.
All right, so let's set this up to say flirting, when it's good, you do need to express yourself, express interest. And the trifling is probably the thing where we're talking about getting out of our boundaries from a Christian context.
Or the big boundless term, defraud.
Yay!
Which can be complicated, but what it means is this idea of expressing intentions you don't plan to follow through
That's
on.
That's right.
And so, to answer your question, do we agree with flirting? I think we all agree that there is some kind of necessary form of expressing your interest, especially considering that we don't have the luxury of the wild, where the mating dance is typically kind of a standard routine for a lot of animals. You watch any National Geographic special or whatever, and you realize that they have some way of displaying their plumage or dancing around or flying or something to demonstrate interest.
Yes, or 19th century Victorian and England Elizabethan, where you set your cap for a man and you have your coming out balls when you're 18 and
your dance cards.
Yeah, so we've had our culturally prescribed versions of trying to have something like the mating dance where something means something. Well, we know in our culture hardly anything means anything anymore, and so it's hard to know what is someone's way of expressing interest.
Or the mating dance is just about mating.
Right. So it's getting straight to the bitness.
I like to wear Birkenstocks as my mating call.
And it sends the signal you mean,
yes,
too, right?
Yes,
if you're up in Boulder, that is going to work for you.
Yes.
That is going to work.
But I think one thing you said, Steve, that's very important is the whole issue of intentionality, you know, and communicating. And this whole process, you're dealing with somebody else's heart and their, you know, deepest desires and things that may well alter the course of their whole life. And so you've really got to, you know, me as a guy, if I express this interest toward a woman, I've got to really realize that there's a whole lot of responsibility. And so I've got to communicate. I've got to be intentional.
And as I've been thinking about this topic of flirting, and sometimes even though I'm obviously not the most successful, or I've had my successes and my failures, but I do try to encourage girls who are going out on first dates or they're meeting guys, and some of them who don't have a lot of experience, drawing out their femininity. And I think the best ways to flirt hinges on that. You have, I tell the girls to, you know, you are a woman and it's okay for them to recognize you as such. You can be softer. You can lift them up, and it's how you interact, I think, to bring out that femininity. And yes, it can go much further on the sexual side, which we'd say is the non-Christian, the inappropriate way to do it. But with men as well, yes, you can tease and joke around, but I don't think that's always flirting per se. It's when they're responding to your feminine side and acknowledging that it's there.
But how about before the first date?
Well, even then, the first time you meet someone.
I mean, you're interested in a guy and you want to let him know in some way. That's one of the questions we get to Boundless all the time. What is appropriate flirting for a girl?
Okay, well, let's go ahead and address that because I went to the internet, which is the source of all wisdom on this topic, and looked at a few dating sites and forums and advice columns and whatnot, and did look up a couple articles called, you know, on how to flirt. And one of them basically lists four categories, one involving eye contact, one body language, touching, and then the way that you speak to someone. And so let's just kind of drill through some of these really quickly, and you guys can give your opinions on what which of these. And, you know, we're not saying this is the be-all, end-all, obviously, for our source of information. But when it comes to making eye contact with someone, they say you should look at them and try to hold to a three-second rule. Four-second rule for Shiloh. So where you are, you know, many people, you'll be in a conversation and you'll kind of be looking about or whatever, but to actually maintain eye contact with that person. Are we okay with maintaining eye contact?
I think that's one of the biggest challenges for people who are reserved and shy, and is just to even count it out, to be intentional. And that's the hardest thing because there's so much vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think eye contact is one of those things that we're always encouraged to do because we are opening up the window to our soul to an extent, but that's part of why it feels vulnerable. But I think it's key.
Okay, what about winking? Or any of
those are it's totally inappropriate unless you're in a relationship.
Winking?
I don't know. Winking.
Well, you know what winking leads to.
Not counting internet winking.
Yes, not counting.
Like I don't think it's necessary.
I don't know
true.
Because winkers tend to be like very frivolous with their winks, and they give them to everybody, and so.
Yeah,
real winkers.
I knew were weirdos.
Weirdo.
I mean, a wink can mean something, but I think you have to be far enough in your flirting relationship or that you're.
If it's in response to something that the person has said or done, you know, like you're just communicating, hey, that was pretty cool, you know, like that.
I don't know.
It's like a grandpa thing in a lot of ways. Oh. I mean, maybe that was just my experience.
I've just been so deceived by so many winkers because I'm always like, oh, really? And
or
then
you
say no.
Then
really.
you turn around and they're winking at your best friend or
so maybe just intentional winks.
Yes.
That are followed up with action.
Yes. If it's intentional, like, you know, if there's some girl who's kind of, you know, winking and, you know, hugging and everybody, it's a turnoff. It really is. You know, if she's, I don't know, expressing some sort of interest.
Wouldn't that go for all forms of flirting, is that you're looking to see it being reserved and exclusive versus broadly given away? It's like diamonds that lose their value when there's too many
in
the marketplace.
But there are still people who get suckered in. I've been suckered in plenty of times. And I know guys have as well. I can't say any names, but someone I know maybe who works here. Who I was
hosting the show?
No, Lisa's very above board. She's very intentional. There was a guy that I was interested in, and I was talking to him one day after chapel, and another young lady came up and interrupted us, and she started touching his shoulder and stroking her hair and tossing it, and he fell like, I don't know. He was a little puppy after her, and I was not there. And I found out just a little bit later that from a coworker, she had no interest in this guy and didn't want to go on a date with him, didn't think he was that attractive. Meanwhile, that started probably several years of him being interested in her. Mm-hmm. And she responds that way to everyone, but if you don't get to see how they treat others like that, you do get caught up with
that. She a big winker too?
No. Oh. She's a big hair tosser.
Hair tossers. Like okay, what about, so that kind of segues into the next area. What about body language? Like, how can you use body language to indicate interest in someone? This article talks about mirroring someone's posture, leaning in when they're talking to show that you're interested in their conversation, What in your experience have you guys seen that works or doesn't work?
Well, once again, I mean, this is where in our overly sexualized culture, it's hard to know when, you know, a little bit of touch can go a long way, because we're in a culture where people have sex and then ask each other's names sometimes. And mm-hmm. so it's, you know, in another day, there was enough sexual restraint that a little could go a long way. The smallest mm-hmm. touch could communicate so much. And now it's the kind of thing that, you know, especially people who are just buddies, I mean, it just all blurs together. And so it's mm-hmm. hard for an appropriate touch to communicate interest, because sometimes people, you know, and too, I'll insert in a Christian community, there's so much brotherly, sisterly hugs and, you know, the Sidewinder hugs especially, that it's hard to know when someone's expressing interest mm-hmm. and when they're just being charismatic.
My dad gave me advice when I was about 17 about reaching over to a man's lapel or shoulder to brush off that imaginary fleck.
The dandruff?
Yeah. Or, you know, just a little piece of lint. Oh, let me get that for you.
See that?
But that's pretty old-fashioned
still. If there
still.
Was, you know, lint or... dandruff on the shoulder, that would be a very
embarrassing.
Nice move.
Well,
nice.
What if the guy has a piece of broccoli in his teeth?
But I think
reach over and
reach over
gently.
With
well, I think just position your body toward the person. Like if you're sitting at a computer and somebody walks in and you're interested in them, you may mm-hmm. just stop typing, turn around, face them, and you know engage mm-hmm. in a conversation that way. That communicates that you're interested in this person.
Okay.
You know, I think behind a lot of this is respect for someone, of mm-hmm. demonstrating honor for them, demonstrating true interest, and in the sense of interest in them as another human, which in some ways can provide a little safety to recognize that even if nothing romantic grows out of it, mm-hmm. that you have been a good friend, that you've demonstrated genuine care and concern for someone. Although, I mean, there are people who are genuinely concerned about others, and it can be misinterpreted mm-hmm. whether or not they're interested in something romantic. But at least it begins there, that is what it grows out of, is a general concern for another person and demonstrating respect and honor to them, which is very different from a sexualized flirting, which really mm-hmm. almost is more animalistic in the sense of you're interacting and flirting because you want it to get to a sexual end mm-hmm. versus wanting to grow in a meaningful relationship with another person.
Mm-hmm. And it's more of taking, you know, with that, you know, you're taking what
insight.
You can from the person, not giving back to them or exploring who they are on a bigger scale.
Yeah, that's good.
And as a guy, when you kind of just are courteous, you know, at least at the start of a relationship or, you know, what you hope to be a relationship, I think there's less potential to kind of be hurt because you're not, you know, putting yourself way, way out there in some extraordinary show of, you know, infatuation or something.
That's good. The final category is words, which we're kind of talking about a little bit here. And would you say, Mark, for example, one of the things they talk about in the article is, you know, singling someone out for conversation, like if you're at a party. Now, would you say if you're at a party and you're interested in someone particularly, you might find a way to be in a conversation with that person?
Yes, this is when creativity really helps, you know. But, you know, there's a balance there. I mean, you can't just single this person out to the exclusion of all her other friends. Then it becomes annoying and you're just, you know, shooting yourself in the foot type of thing. But, yeah.
But what if you try to diffuse it by talking with a lot of other people? I don't know. I guess I see men either give the mixed signals and they're very flirtatious or seeking attention of a woman, and then they repeat that with five other girls at the same party, or you have the guys who are so timid about it that you know, it really just does seem like they just came over to check out those double dark chocolate brownies. I'd like to know maybe successes with Ted and Steve. Like, when was do you remember flirting with your wife? And what was the first time? Was it?
Well, in church, I invited Ashley to a small group and she came. And after church once, she had mentioned that she had made some vegetable lasagna. And so I invited myself over to her house mm-hmm. with my roommate.
and said, we'd like to come over and try your lasagna. And while I was there, my roommate Matt was, you know, he was talking to her and stuff, and I was looking at Ashley's bookshelf. And that communicated something, I guess.
That is so flirtatious. That's almost like over the top. He's talking to her and you're overlooking at the bookshelf.
Well, you know.
And it's funny because Candace and I, our first conversation was about a book. We were both reading, or I'm sorry, she was interested in what I was reading, some Douglas Copeland book at the time. And she went out and bought the book so we'd have something to talk about.
That's but, sneaky. That's good.
Ted was actually a little more intentional than I was. I mean, I was coming off some of those who are more familiar with Boundless know I've written an article about the buddy approach that I tried, that I crashed and burned enough trying to flirt with people that I landed on the let's just be buddies approach, where I was creating all the confusion we talk about on this program. And it was hard to discern where I was invested in a relationship and where I wasn't because of my just friends type approach. And so I don't think
Steve
I'm going to win
why
any.
We exist at Boundless.
I don't win any awards for intentionality, so that's why I just preach to encourage other guys to be. No, I'm kidding.
Learn from Steve's mistakes.
But seriously, I say that because I don't think any guy who has muddied their way through it is going to boast about their track record, their successful path to marriage. And I think most of us can respect and honor a guy who is intentional, who is willing to crash and burn potentially. But as we're saying, I think you can start safely by respectfully being a gentleman and being friendly and just slowly distinguishing your friendly interaction in such a way that it's obvious you're not just being a gentleman to everyone. You're building on your gentleman quality with something that says, I am singling you out. I see potential for more.
But what do you do with the flirting? We still haven't addressed. I mean, looking at someone's bookshelf is not.
Well,
it doesn't work
for everybody. Time with her. She worked at the grad school that I had graduated from. And I stopped by there to visit one of the professors, and I stopped by and chatted with her afterwards. Another thing, she reviewed CDs for some like Amazon and so on, and so I offered to help her evaluate a CD, so we listened to it together and brought out some points together. So what I did was I tried to learn what interested her and what she was involved with, and I sort of came alongside that.
Well, it sounds like you're giving good tips on being intentional.
It was fun,
but
I mean, I enjoyed
flirting?
It, she enjoyed it, I got the girl.
Yeah. Some people just have this flirting relationship that stays at one stagnant level. And I think they kind of find a certain amount of enjoyment in it. But it's got to have a trajectory. And I think it's got to lead to something formal. Either, a typical first step is, what are you doing Friday night? I'd love to take you out. Or from there, we've been going out a couple of times. I mean, several times there seems to be chemistry here. I'd love to see if we can date exclusively. And so it's got to have some trajectory. And I think that's what we miss the most in our pseudo-friendship dating culture now, is a sense of trajectory and moving into that next level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think it's tricky because I think maybe some of the guys that we know have to be so certain that a girl is interested in them before they ask her out that they want to eliminate all risk. So then it puts them in this perpetual cycle
of weirdness.
That's the
purpose of dating, is to...
Yeah, I mean, it becomes this unending flirt cycle. And then the women don't want to risk themselves because they'll probably be like, oh, he's just being nice or he's being whatever. So then they just kind of shut down and don't do anything. So, well, these are good thoughts. And I think we will definitely want to solicit some ideas and experiences from our listeners at editor@boundless.org. Please write to us with what you think on this topic, because three of us are still single, so we obviously still need the tips, and we're not, you know, we're going to try the bookshelf thing, we'll try it and let you know how it works for us, but in the meantime, do tell us, you know, what has worked for you and what hasn't, and just what you think about flirting in general, so we want to talk about it more.
What a tragedy. Take me by surprise. It took me far too long to recognize disguise. In a world where truth and love can be so hard to find, there comes a time.
for today's culture segment here on The Boundless Show, I have with me in the studio Tom Minnery. Tom is a longtime Focus on the Family employee. How long now, Tom?
Oh, I've been here for 21 years.
Whoa, he practically owns the place, people. So, no, Tom works extremely closely with Dr. Dobson as our senior vice president in charge of public policy here at Focus on the Family, which really he wears a number of different hats related to that role because we not only do public policy media work, but we also interface with constituents. We do interfacing with other organizations and whatnot through a basically a separate organization now, Focus on the Family Action. So we have a lot going on different fronts, and Tom kind of heads all of that up and tries to keep us legal and tries to keep us effective, and I think is doing a great job on all those fronts. So welcome, Tom.
Well, thanks. Happy to be with you.
Woohoo. All right. Well, we want to talk about the subject of social justice today. And Tom, you know, we have a lot of readers of our blog, a lot of listeners to this podcast who are passionate about what would classically be defined as social justice. And it's being bandied about a lot, the term, in light of the elections this year. And so we want to kind of give a not only a biblical perspective on what that means and what an evangelical's role is with that, but what that means in light of the elections and really how that should affect our choices when it comes to candidates and the issues that are at stake. So why don't you start out, Tom, by just giving us a definition of what you feel social justice is as it's being described in the media, and then maybe a biblical perspective on that.
Yeah, Jesus used a word to define that concept, and he did that in the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes part of the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. He said in the fourth Beatitude, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." And then he came back to that same word in the eighth Beatitude, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness." And then he launches into some very familiar words. He said, don't be afraid when people revile you, when they say all manner of evil against you. They got a problem with me. And then he said, do not hide your light under a bushel. Let it shine before all men. You are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. That's a tremendous command for whatever this thing called righteousness is. Mm-hmm. And I've gone to work a little bit on the Greek word dikaiosune is the word translated as righteousness. And all it means is what is right. My favorite definition of that term is found in 1 John. That verse says, he who does what is right is righteous. And we are commanded to do what is right. That, to me, defines social justice, and it comes right from Jesus' own words.
Okay. So we see a lot of criticism then from some of the younger evangelicals who are saying, we're not doing enough. The church isn't doing enough. Then we would have other evangelicals who, you know, how do we reconcile what the government is responsible for, which there's a certain, you know, percentage of folks who think the government needs to be doing more, versus what really is our responsibility as the church?
Well, the government continues to try and overstep its boundary to elbow away the private sector, compassion, people's duty to give of their resources, to help those less fortunate. Compassion is a good part of social justice, a good reason why Christians are involved in doing good. Compassion means suffering with people. The government is not very good at compassion. First of all, it wastes a lot of money. Second, government does not give people things out of the beneficence of its own loving heart. All government does is follow the regulations. If you have a right to have this money, then it comes to you. If you do not have a right based on this regulation, you do not get that. It's very cold, very calculating, as it must be, because it's the product of the political process. Compassion comes from the heart. I want to do something because I'm suffering with you. And we have allowed government to overtake the private sector, particularly the church, in the compassion realm, that when we think of doing something nice for people, we no longer think of our own responsibility too many times. We too many times think of what can the government do? What should the government do? And that's a standard politically liberal reply. And that reply is based on this thinking. You're in a bad situation. That makes me feel bad. I will raise somebody's taxes so I can take that tax money and give it to you, then you won't feel bad, and that makes me feel good. Mm-hmm. That's the liberal political response to somebody in need. Whereas I think Jesus would say, if somebody is suffering, reach into your own pocket and help them. That's the message of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan was someone who was faced with a Jew laying in the middle of the road. Jews hated Samaritans. This guy, of all people, had reason to step over that Jew and go on about his way. He did not. He put the man on his own donkey, reached into his own pocket to help the Jew. Boy, that's a powerful command to help people, even people who don't deserve it, from our own pockets. And you can see, that's not government's way. That's our personal responsibility. And I was never more proud of Christian social organizations than I was in the wake of that terrible destruction of Hurricane Katrina that slammed into Mississippi, slammed into Louisiana, caused such destruction. I remember reading one of the first stories in the aftermath of that. I read it in the New York Times. The government had released a list of agencies that it advised people to give money to if they wanted to help solve the problem. And of about 12 agencies listed, I think 11 of them were Christian social agencies. That is compassion, because the private sector, particularly people who do good out of their own hearts, do a better job and are more efficient. So that's a roundabout way of addressing that issue of social justice.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the, in light of the kind of the classic issues that are associated with evangelicalism. We've talked some on the Boundless team about how there seems to be this abortion fatigue out there, especially among younger voters, younger Christians, and how, you know, we've gotten responses from people, you know, let's just stop talking about abortion. We've worked on it for over 30 years now and just nothing's happening. Let's start focusing on these other issues. Let's talk about AIDS. Let's talk about poverty. Let's talk, how can we keep Christians, evangelicals, energized about these issues that are still so critical. Tom wrote a book called Why You Can't Stay Silent, and really calling the church to the need for standing up for what we believe, getting involved, being the ones, the voice in our culture to say what's important and to toe the line on that. How can we keep Christians energized and passionate and true to the truth on this?
Well, it's difficult because the issues that are in greatest need of advancing are those that we have been fighting for a long time. And I can see why people would be tired of the pro-life issue. But slowly, since that Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, we have been chewing away at the abortion industry, chewing away at abortion as a solution by the tremendous growth of pregnancy resource centers, the tremendous growth of regulations and state laws that require, for example, women to be told what really happens in an abortion, for a 24-hour waiting period, for parental consent regulations. And slowly, we are returning to a pro-life majority view in this country, and it's the result of a lot of hard, fatiguing work. Many times, public policy is a slow grind. But abortion is a big issue. A lot of people would rather go for the glitzy issues that the left-leaning media loves, which is global warming and AIDS relief in Africa. And there are some organizations whose divine calling is to address those issues. And we applaud that. That's another arena of social justice. But there's a danger. The danger is this. The danger is that because the media loves those issues and because the media dislikes the issue of abortion and the traditional definition of marriage, those latter two issues tend to be controversial. And any leader who grasps onto the global warming issue tends to be highlighted in the media and treated well, and that's always a danger for Christian leaders when they gravitate toward one issue simply because the world likes that issue. The important thing is, do not let your involvement be determined by what is controversial. Mm-hmm. Sometimes that standing for righteousness requires controversy, and Jesus knew that when he said in Matthew 5, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness." He knew way back then that certain issues would be controversial at certain times and certain issues would be received well by the world, and he did not want people to be dislodged from their calling simply because something is controversial. Hmm.
And I love how, you know, I mean, here's something that everyone can get behind, the family. I love what Focus is doing, and I love what you've said, Tom, in the past, that really the best way to fight poverty, the best way to support families or to keep marriages together, to support the unit of the family. Talk a little bit just about how Focus is doing that and really how we're passionate about the family as a whole and how that relates to public policy efforts.
You know, I love when reporters ask me, why don't you fight poverty? and I say, I love it because I say we fight poverty every day. Oh, yeah, well, do you support government programs? No. Mm-hmm. William Bennett, I think, was the first one who called the family, the nuclear family, the original Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. Mm. If you can keep the family intact, then you can keep fathers and mothers, husbands and wives, from poverty. And you can give their children the best environment for being raised as healthy, productive adults who can make their own way in the world, and they will avoid poverty. It starts with the intact family. The statistics are overwhelming that shows that when a family breaks up, poverty is much more likely, and usually it's the woman who's stuck with the kids and without good job skills who declines into poverty. So we fight poverty every day.
Hmm. Well, we will definitely have to have you back, Tom, to continue talking about this. I think that's a great just a great charge to all of us, even as singles, because we're trying to move folks through that continuum as they come out of college. They're thinking of starting a family on their own. Many of them maybe came out of broken homes. They're fearful of divorce. They're grappling with a lot of challenges, getting on their feet as far as careers. But to really be encouraged that there is hope for the family. There's obviously hope through the Word of God and through the plan that He has for families. And we need to rally, especially now in this season of our lives as young adults, to get involved on the local level, to do what we're called to do through the scriptures, and then to be responsible citizens in the process and to stand up, as you say in your book, and to speak out for the unborn, for those who, you know, for those who really need a voice in our culture, and ultimately to represent the Lord Jesus Christ well in the decisions we make. So,
well, thanks. That's well said, and I enjoy being with you, Lisa.
Thanks, Tom.
Do you remember, girl, all the loves you know? They promised you the world if you'd just be their own. Girl, you should know by now that I'm not that kind. All I can offer you if you want it is just a good time. But don't you want to come away? Come away for the summer. Don't you want to come away? Come away with me.
That was Jim Waters, kicking it old school. He is the father of Steve Waters, who is bringing us this week's Hungry Ears segment, where he asks the question, does it matter how we use the talents God gives us?
It's during our 20s that we often discover our talents, the things we seem to be able to do better than other things. But it's also during that time that we can be tempted to use our talents for our own purposes, to want to make a name for ourselves or make a lot of money. That was the struggle my dad had in his 20s. Before he was born, Dad's mom made a promise to God, "If you'll give me a son, I'll give him back to you to be a preacher." When God answered her prayer, she did her best to keep her promise, telling Dad about God and the calling on his life. She and my grandpa watched with pride as my dad's gifts began to emerge. He rose quickly through the ranks of the Boy Scouts. He wrote deep thoughts in his journal, and he showed leadership over his three younger brothers. Dad told people later that he discovered another talent he had in church one morning. He said, "We were all singing, and I heard a good voice, and then I realized it was my own." Now, if God was planning to use my dad in ministry, like my grandma had hoped, it appeared he had gifted him for that work. At 17, Dad became a Christian and started thinking about going to Bible school. Around this time, however, a big detour presented itself. It was the 1960s, a time when the frenzied excitement over rock music got budding vocalists and musicians thinking they could be the next to break out. Between his growing love for music and a desire for independence that came with maturity, Dad had a new focus. He wanted to be a rock star. His mom didn't take this news well and insisted that Dad was called to the ministry. At one point, they argued about his calling, and Dad said, "You didn't have any right to tell God what I was going to do with my life." A little later, Dad met a guy named Barney at a music store who was interested in starting a band. Their first gig was at the Moose Lodge in New Bern, North Carolina, where they played a concert that was filled with covers of popular songs. They all agreed it was pretty bad, but the crowd didn't think so. They loved it. The Lodge asked the band to play again. They decided to name themselves The Shadows and made Dad their lead singer. Dad and Barney treated their band like a business and worked hard to keep it booked as much as 18 months in advance. As often as possible, they were out on the road with a regular schedule that included military nightclubs, street concerts, bar mitzvahs, and proms. As the gigs grew steady and the payouts got bigger, Dad saw the financial potential of his talents and came up with a big goal: to make $1 million by the time he turned 25. The Shadows eventually ran their course, but Dad kept finding success with other bands, and his goal was still in reach. He formed the Brotherhood, the Entertainers, the Vogues, and other bands. Dad was even given his own local television show, The Jim Waters Show. When he was 24, Dad and his band, the Brotherhood, drove to Memphis to record at the famous Sun Studio. They laid down tracks until 3 in the morning and then headed back to their hotel. In the hotel restaurant, they bumped into Mac Davis, who was a popular singer at the time. After a brief conversation, Davis said, "Well, I need to go see an old friend." "Who's that?" my dad asked. "Elvis," Davis answered. Dad's eyes widened, and he said, "Oh, I'd give anything to meet Elvis." Elvis was the king of rock and roll at the time. He had everything my dad wanted: the talent, the respect, the money, and an almost supernatural ability to move a crowd. "I tell you what," Davis said, "go up to the gate at the front entrance and introduce yourself to Elvis's uncle, Vester." So at 3:30 a.m., they drove down to Graceland. When they found the guardhouse, they introduced themselves to Uncle Vester, who treated them to stories about Elvis. While they were there, they gave Uncle Vester a picture of the band, hoping he'd pass it on. Elvis got the picture, and the band got an autographed picture in return. Dad was excited, but things were about to get even more interesting. While they were chatting, limos started moving their way. It was Mac Davis, Elvis, and his entourage. Uncle Vester looked at my dad and asked, "Do you want to go where he's going?" "Of course," Dad replied. Where he was going was the Memphian Theater, a place Elvis often rented out after midnight to screen films. Dad and his band hardly noticed the movie because of their excitement about being able to hang out with Elvis. The highlight was when Elvis came back to them and asked, "You guys all right? Can I get you anything?" Growing up, this was my favorite family story. In fact, it's the chapter of Dad's life I often told because those that followed didn't seem as exciting. Within a year or so of meeting Elvis, Dad decided to give it all up. The spotlight, the money, everything he had been living for. He left the road and looked for something else to do with his life. For a while, he wandered around doing a variety of jobs to support our family. What happened? Well, the real turning point was the strange emotion that came over Dad as he sat there in the Memphian Theater. As exciting as it was to be on the top of his game as an entertainer, Dad was overwhelmed by a strong urge welling up inside him to talk to Elvis about God, about things that really mattered. Having that experience made Dad think pretty hard about the life he was living, though. How could he be a witness for God when he knew he wasn't where God wanted him to be? It's a thought that had been boiling up in him for a while, and it brought him back to the question about the talents God had given him. Ultimately, Dad knew that the money and recognition weren't a sufficient reward for his talents. He knew he had the power to move a crowd, but to what end? He wasn't making their lives much better. He was just helping them escape from their problems. And so Dad left the rock scene and surrendered his plans for his talents to whatever bigger plans God might have for him. While God was faithful to lead Dad in those bigger plans, it did require Dad to settle for much smaller paychecks and smaller crowds. But Dad would have been the first to tell you it was a time his heart was at peace, because he knew he was offering up his gifts for things that mattered. During the last half of his life, the people Dad touched couldn't imagine that his talents had ever been used for anything other than singing and preaching the good news of God's love for lost sinners. As far as they knew, that's exactly what he was created to do.
Opening up this week's inbox, we have a question actually from a couple who are mentoring couples in their church, and I have with me in the studio Mott Brown to address this question. This question is from Bruce and Debbie, and I really love this question, Mott, because I think it not only addresses a point that many couples in our churches are currently at, but I think it's also good to give kind of that call to married couples out there to start investing in people in your church, because obviously it's very necessary, as you will see here. So it looks like Bruce is speaking in this question, so I will go ahead and read it. My wife and I work with young adults at our church. Most of the young people coming for advice have already been together for 6 months or even 2 to 3 years. They have not begun their courtship following biblical principles. They have pulled away from others, shared emotional and physical intimacy, and become very attached and dependent on each other. Then they come to us and ask how to be sure if this is the one, or with concerns that they argue or can't resolve differences. It seems to me that they're too close to look at things objectively, and very often they do not know each other very well. They've spent their dating time doing fun things and going to romantic places and staring into each other's eyes, but not discussing their convictions, hopes, dreams, and insights. I wish I could rewind the tape and have them start over and approach a courtship in a biblical manner, but of course I can't. I'm afraid some of these couples will move forward into marriage just because they would find it too painful to break up or back up at this point. How can we help someone build a solid foundation after they're already so involved with each other? It seems like we're trying to get a foundation under a house that is already up.
You know, Lisa, the question really reminded me of my own dating relationship with my wife. We had built a house without laying a foundation. And thankfully, we had a mentor who came alongside me at 7-8 months into my relationship. And I think he saw in me what Bruce is seeing in a lot of these couples, these even well-intentioned couples that are doing things very badly. I was doing things badly in my relationship. I didn't have the foundation. What that foundation is a goal, an end in mind, which is marriage. Bruce talks of couples who have been dating for 2 to 3 years. And yeah, you date 2 to 3 years if you don't have that in mind, if you haven't laid that foundation. And you can't go back, really. But what you can do, and I appreciate this couple too, what you can do is go to these couples. The man can go to the man, and the woman can go to the woman and challenge them, like I was challenged. The specific challenge I was given was, you have been dating this woman for 7-8 months. That's plenty long enough to know whether or not you want to marry her. So you need to either get married or break up. So that's the advice I got. I broke up with Beth, who was at that time my girlfriend. I pursued advice from mentors I was seeing because I was challenged to do that. I was challenged to reevaluate my relationship, to look again at what I was doing, to be intentional. And so we ended up getting married because of that, because I loved her, because I had taken the advantage of her. I'd been receiving a benefit of a wife from her. So I think that this, you know, I'd say to this mentor couple is that they need to be willing to ask the hard questions.
I think too, Mott, what do you think about just the, what needs to be evaluated in these relationships? Because I think, for example, I mean, that's assuming your situation obviously worked out. So you obviously were both reasoned believers and were in a local church and were, you know, had mentorship to avail yourself of. But what about Bruce and Debbie going after some of these couples that, one, maybe don't even want input in their life? Two, maybe they are just out, you know, choosing decorating styles and hanging out with each other's families and whatever, and they don't even know what questions to ask. So how are Bruce and Debbie supposed to kind of start the conversation with these couples?
A good idea, like I mentioned before, is to sort of separate them, divide and conquer. I think the man needs to approach the man and to gently and lovingly ask him hard questions. You know, if if the woman's father isn't going to ask what this man's intentions are, then a couple that knows them well needs to become involved. So I think what are your intentions is a good place to start. And really, once you establish that, it can go very well. If a young man is beginning at that point, I think he's going to look at her a bit differently. He is going to start to treat her more carefully and want to pursue that relationship more carefully so that they aren't just recreationally dating, that he may look at her differently if he thinks of her as his wife or a future wife. And he may start to more seriously consider the relationship, because it looks like, you know, the examples that they gave, that they're very invested and they're very serious with each other, but they're more serious just for the sake of relationship, just because they enjoy the relationship, not because they're seeking to know whether or not this other person is supposed to be their wife or husband.
Mm-hmm. I think that's when, you know, like when Bruce and Debbie kind of have their work cut out for them, because I think so many couples go into a relationship because it's, oh my goodness, this person's showing interest in me. This person makes me feel a certain way. And so then they get caught up in this thing, you know, and end up 6 months in, or goodness gracious, mm-hmm. 2 to 3 years, whatever. And I think what I was getting at in my previous question was the value of a mentor in sitting down and starting to go through some of those bottom line, as they say, foundational criteria of, you know, what if you've built this huge connection with a person and then you realize they're not serious about their faith? And oh my goodness, I'm so clouded in my understanding of them because they're so nice to me. They're so good to me. We have so much fun together. We have such a connection. I'm just fearful of so many couples out there that are really giving away, not only giving away too much, but just letting too many things slide because they're just assuming that somewhere down the road, something miraculous is going to happen. And all of a sudden this person's going to turn into John Piper. Yeah. And it's not going to happen, people.
The relationship is based on the fact that they like the same movies.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, we have
or
a tool.
Camping in Colorado.
Or camping, or just, you know, similar interests, which aren't bad, but they do need to be asking more substantive questions. And we have a good tool on Boundless. I think we've mentioned it before, the DTR assessment. It's the Define the Relationship Assessment. And it goes a little deeper than just movie choices. You know, it gets into your faith and pretty specific questions about your beliefs and about roles within marriage, about children. And those are really important questions that they may not have considered at all, and that they have just majored on the minors and not majored on the majors. And you know what? That's what happens. That's what happens when people go into a relationship and aren't intentional about it. They just sort of float along enjoying that person's company.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Well, take the DTR, folks. Go out and find a mentor if you don't already have one. And quite frankly, I mean, I think it can be painful. I mean, you're going to have to open up your life to these people, and you're going to have to open up your relationship to these people. And they might say some hard things, you know. But I think we need to just stop messing around on this front. And, you know, honestly, if you've wasted 2 years in a relationship, you know, you're not any better than where you started. So just figure it out now and find out a way to really inject some biblical wisdom into that. I think that would be helpful for everyone. That's it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Again, we always love to have you sitting in, listening with us, and we want to hear your feedback. We need to know you're out there. So write to us at editor@boundless.org, whether you have a question for our inbox or you just want to say hi. Hi. Please do so. Also, if you are on Facebook, make sure that you check out the Boundless Flare that I created, if I have not already shamelessly sent it to you, which I should have, if you are a friend of mine and are a Boundless listener. So pass it on to your friends, tell other people about the show, give us your show ideas, and we will see you around next time.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on the family.